stands for an experience. It is not an experience. It stands for an experience. It's an index to an experience.
Well, now, in your own work, are not these forms of yours merely symbols?
No, they're not signs at all. These are forms which are born out of emotions. I select them when I believe these forms are equivalent to what I'm trying to say. If they don't, I have failed.
Now, do these forms that you see, Mr. Millard, when you go to the exhibition, do they convey to you something about the particular?
Well, now, I'm going to repeat, gentlemen, that I'm not going to let you scholarly gentlemen get me into deep water. I'm speaking as a layman. I disagree with Father Duncan. I don't think every one of those works have to be explained to me, but I do make the point that the average layman going to that show without any knowledge of what he might say will be completely amazed and bewildered. And as a layman, I want to say this, that I like to think in going to an exhibition like that, that I might as well be going over to an engineering laboratory or a scientific laboratory where something started long ago is now progressing. And I believe out of this contemporary art that some of us might smile at a bit, something great eventually will come out of it. I'm sure of that.
Well, I think that's very good, and I think it's optimistic. I think artists would
I
be
think
very...
I think it's very optimistic, Mr. Shipley. I think that certainly there is something coming out of it. Now, whether it's going to be great or not remains to be seen, and I would like to be on record here...
You think
here.
That's important?
Oh, I think it's important, definitely. I think it's important. But I'd like to be on record here as indicating that I am not speaking of this exhibit in its totality. When I take exception to parts of it, I mean just that, certain works. I think that many of these works are of a very high caliber, even to my limited capacity to understand art in the technical sense. But I simply hold out that some of these things, which are described variously, one, for instance, I overheard a young man to the rear of me looking at one of the pictures saying, well, it looks as though he just forgot to clean up his palette when he got through. Now that
whose
type
work
of
was
a,
that? Do you recall?
Well, this I believe was Pollock's work, Jackson Pollock's work. And it looks as though the man just dribbled around a few tubes of various colors. And
in fact, that's what he does, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, perhaps it is, but I find it very difficult, frankly, to grasp just exactly what rare form he could be giving expression to in what, to any ordinary mortal's view, seems to be certainly a random wandering of the dribbling paint on a canvas. Now, I would say this, that perhaps something is to be said for the combination of colors. And it has been said, for instance, that the particular work to which I have reference indicates a flower. Well, to my mind, any group of colors could somehow vaguely remind a person of a flower, or for that matter, of a flag.
No, I think I was referring that to Mr. Feitelson's remark that it need not have a message, that you value a flower because you enjoy looking at it. And
I
that
mean.
In approaching Mr. Pollock's work, you merely look at it as a combination of colors or as a design. And I think it would be perfectly possible, perhaps as a moderator, I shouldn't be entering into this, but I think it would be perfectly possible to take a child over to see Mr. Pollock's work who hadn't been conditioned by some prior, knowledge or prior education as to what to look for in a picture. And he would enjoy Mr. Pollock's work for what it is. Now,
exactly.
I'd like to bring Mr. Feitelson back into this, because he's when we were talking about this before, he said art need not have a message, and he used the simile of the flower himself.
That's right. I believe that creation in itself is a wonderment, and if it carries the imprint of the individual is more important, and the more important man is, the more important is society, and therefore, as I believe, he's worth saving. And it's only the inner man that is of true value. We still judge, and I hope we still judge, a man by his inner qualities rather than by things.
May I interrupt now for a second? I just didn't like for you to mention your limited capacity, because as a layman, I still want to be the one gentleman on this panel discussion that has limited capacity. I think your capacity, gentlemen, is unlimited, except mine.
Thanks, Mr. Millard.
Well, as I recall, Mr. Millard, you pointed out that the flower, if we use that simile again, that one doesn't ask of it values, material values. Isn't that right?
That's right. Its beauty is enough for me.
And I suppose the artist would hope that the beauty of the painting, once understood, would be sufficient.
I think that's right.
I think since we have a representative god here, I'm going to use an analogy, which I use very often, and I sincerely believe is a true analogy. And that is that since man, and the good book tells us, has been made in the image of God, he becomes God in his short span, lifespan, when he creates or gives form or gives a totality or creates a universe of his own experiences only. And this is the artist's privilege. And I think this is the artist's desire. And the immortality of that experience means everything to the artist. And that's why we say Michelangelo is a great artist simply because his work lives. We use the word live. It persists. It persists on universal qualities. And these qualities are not the historic. We know very little. Most of the people know very little about his times. Only the scholar knows. And also, we know that these works are not because of anatomical abilities. There are many students that can out or give better demonstrations of anatomy because we know more about it today. All you've got to do is pick up Gray's Anatomy and copy it. So it must be something outside of these physical representations. It's what he has done with the lines that create the rhythm, what he has done with the model. And that is no different than what Pollock does with things which represent nothing. It's the quality, the universal emotional quality that these things possess, which have immortality if it is done by an artist with keen sensibilities.
Well, Mr. Feitelson, I see your point, the point you are making here, and I think that perhaps my difficulty would arise from the distinction, if you will, between what you call emotional and what I would call, and it's a different thing, intellectual. I believe that the creations of the artist, as the creations, as you yourself point out, of man, made in the image and likeness of God, should bear at least the imprint of the intellectual, and to that extent should have some inner coherence, if you will, and should have some means of communication with the outside world. Because I believe that understanding, if we ask, do you understand a work of art? There's right there in the expression understanding, we have the connotation of the intellect, of the mind, of the ability to grasp what the artist is putting down on his canvas. And I think that that's the point I'm trying to get at, and that it is difficult to see how, in completely random forms, as I see in some of these works, there is an intellectual and therefore a truly human quality. There may be, and now Mr. Shipley points out, that a child exposed to the work that we referred to, the work of Pollock, might be, he's unconditioned, and therefore he may react very favorably. Yes, I grant that. But I say that perhaps the reason that the child responds so favorably to bright splashes of color with no apparent relation or form is precisely because he's unconditioned, because he has no intellectual approach to the problem. And it seems to me that great art must bear somehow the imprint of the intellectual. Otherwise, it could be completely without relation to anything except the emotional, or to go lower, to the purely physical in man. And I think that's what we're trying to get away from.
You're saying then that man is more than an emotional being.
Yes, I think man as an intellectual being reaches his fullest dignity and his fullest stature, and so far as I interpret the Bible, to be made in the image and likeness of God refers precisely to that spiritual part of man that we know as his soul and as the seat of his mind and his willpower.
There seems to be a disagreement here between the emotional man and the soul of man. I think that Mr. Feitelson seems to be identifying them as one. I'm not sure about that.
You're
not. You're saying that the soul of man is intellectual, not emotional. And Mr. Feitelson says the soul of man is emotional.
Otherwise, the soul has no identity. It's a totality of the inner man, which compared to the totality of the other man, just like we have the face or the physical differences, creates, the synthesis creates what we call the soul. The soul is a total of it. It's not any anatomical part of it. It's the total. Like we say, the soul of a nation. It either has a soul or it hasn't. When they all have a similar cult, and they're seeking a similar kind of an activity, we call that a soul of a nation. And we say he expresses the soul of a nation. This artist is a soul of a nation, or a soul of a belief.
But Father Duncan's point is that this soul is also intellectual. It's knowing. And I could refer back to Mr. Millard's point of view. That is, he wants to go to these pictures and understand. All he asks is that he have some prior indoctrination so that he knows where to begin in looking at these pictures. Is that right, Mr. Millard?
That's right, and I would like to have one of the artists at my right sometime. And now, will you please, sir, explain to me just what you were trying to convey on that canvas to my feeble mind? Listen intently to what he had to say.
I think that's a good point. I believe that the very words that Mr. Millard uses, the word indoctrination, for instance, itself refers to a grasp, an understanding of something. And in just one more word on this distinction between emotion and the intellect, I would quote, for instance, a common example. We see a woman, let's say, who is ruled, someone might say, she's ruled by her emotions. She doesn't use her head. She's completely emotional. Well, that is just roughly is the type of distinction that I was trying to make, that the emotion is the, if you will, almost the involuntary reaction that we have to a given situation, whereas the intellectual appraisal of it is something that is more mature.
Well, animals are emotional, but only man is intellectual, and he has controlled his environment. Wouldn't you say?
Definitely.
And he controls his emotions and thereby makes a better world. When he gives vent to let himself go to unbridled emotions, then you have chaos.
That's right.
Definitely.
And so
I believe that the emotions has not what we say intellect, but intelligence. It has its own intelligence. It has its own equilibrium. And that is the difference between a good work of art that is intuitive and a bad work of art. There's a critical faculty within its own intelligence.
I don't know whether I can summarize this thing or not. There's been several viewpoints expressed here. It seems to me that from Mr. Millard's point of view, it is primarily regrettable that so many people attend an exhibition of this kind without any, let's call it indoctrination. And so they look at the, they have no chance to understand because they don't know where to begin. He points out that if there was some way that they could be told ahead of time, then their enjoyment would be increased. From Father Duncan's standpoint, he feels that the artist has every right to express his concept as he feels it, but he believes the tendency of today's art toward a purely subjective and individualistic point of view is regrettable. I think he feels that it fails to take into consideration the basic unity of the human race and the basic reality as you might find it in God. Now, Mr. Feitelson's viewpoint is that the artist must work with the inner world, the spiritual. By so doing, he expresses the deepest experiences of his inner world, and in so doing, he creates a duality which makes his work universal. You have been listening to a tape-recorded festival forum. Listen next Monday afternoon for another forum. This program was produced by Rosalind Biasen. This is the University of Illinois Radio Service.